Up next, Kathleen Stevenson interviews Odile Ugonu-Haber, chairperson of a new campaign focused on the Middle East as part of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and Yvonne Simmons of the local WILF branch.
I'm speaking with Odile Ugonu-Haber. She is in Portland as part of WILF's Middle East campaign. And WILF, of course, is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She is a co-chair of the national campaign of WILF and co-chair of the Middle East campaign. Odile, welcome to KABU. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for welcoming me. It's nice to be welcomed in Portland, well known for its activism.
And I should say that also with Odile is Yvonne Simmons, well known to many KABU listeners for her work in various issues, including work with WILF. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, thank you.
So, Odile, could you start out by talking a little bit about how you got involved with this particular campaign?
Well, I am a member of WILF. I have been for a long time a woman in black since 1987, kind of not long after the beginning of the Women in Black movement in Jerusalem. I went there, saw the woman in black, decided to become a woman in black, and came back in Berkeley and started one of the first Women in Black protest vigil in Berkeley around 1987, and was for 7 years on the street every week. And my activism has evolved, and I became a member of WILF. And I thought that it was very important to kind of understand more the issue of the Middle East. So I formed the Middle East Committee, or reformed one, because there used to be one, but it was not active anymore. And after getting a group of women to be part of this committee, we were a group of wise women, as we call ourselves, and we brought a proposal for a campaign. And this proposal got voted by the membership as one of the two winning proposals, so we became a national campaign. And the name of our campaign is Women Challenge U.S. Policy Building Peace and Justice in the Middle East. It means that we have to educate ourselves about U.S. policy, and we also have to learn about the Middle East and learn ways of building peace and justice.
And so tell us a little bit about what the activities of the campaign involved so far.
So far, the campaign have been reaching out to branches and trying to assess what are branches doing around the Middle East, what do they need in terms of resources, what do they have to offer us in terms of resources also, because WILF members have been long-time activists and there is a lot of expertise in those branches. And we are also working on developing documents. In WILF, the Women International League for Peace and Freedom, we've kind of always based our analysis on feminism. And Jane Addams was one of the first founder of WILF. And I think it's a woman organization because through women's eyes, we see the world in a different way, I think, than the patriarchal world that we live in. And so we have a different agenda, and our agenda is not addressed. And we realize that all women all over the world or this planet have kind of the same agenda. It's very common, very much alike. And that in most of the government, we have very little representation. And so we don't see our agenda addressed. And that kind of creates instant solidarity between women all over the world. We have the same need for basic human desire for a better life and for a life of our children, to nurture the life of our children, to make sure that they become as well as they can full human beings with all kind of possibilities in front of them. And we also care about our community, the way our community live, because it takes a whole village, you know, as to have a quality of life. That's what I was looking for, that give us the right to pursue happiness.
And you have an interesting background, especially regarding the Middle East. You've spent quite a bit of time there. Can you talk a little bit about your own experience in the Middle East?
I went there with my husband. We had a little project before I even joined WILF called the Megiddo Peace Project. And so this project was to create a peace festival on a place of Armageddon, kind of not wait for the destruction of the world, but say there is enough destruction upon us. Why not turning our heart toward peace now? And, you know, turning our heart and live on this planet in a more harmonious way with one another, consider the rule of love. But we didn't want to start a project, you know, coming from United States without knowing what was on the ground. So we spent a long time of going inside Israel, speaking to peace activists, so many people who were doing work for peace. So we met one by one, and we also spent time in the occupied territory, Palestine, speaking to activists there and people who hope for peace, and meeting them one-to-one there. We spent a lot of time just meeting people, and every trip we went, and we went about 12, 13 times, to make sure that we get a good understanding of what's the possibilities there. So whatever work we do, reinforce the work of the local peace movement rather than to just bring something from another land without any consideration for the people who live there and who develop peace there or justice there, whatever. Many people don't want to use the word peace anymore because they feel that this word has been used, you know, like a peace process, but really it was a way of seizing land, destroying houses, a process that was very hypocritical and not open-hearted. So they said, let's find other words for this process now. So maybe understanding, shared humanity, coexistence are better words than using the word of peace.
Well, I'll try not to use it in this question, but what sense did you get of people of that particular perspective in Israel, people who are not pro-policies, present-day policies of Israel? What sense did you get of that movement? Is it large, small?
Yes, I feel that considering Israel is a very small country, within Israel there is many, many peace activists. You know, at times there is huge demonstration coming together there. I am not very good with numbers, so I always avoid to quote number because I make the mistake and then my husband, that was not the number at all. So, but I can tell you that I was impressed on how many people through doing work through schools, through nurse to doctors program, through meeting to meeting, through coexistence with artists, trying to understand the other, trying to meet them. You know, it's never enough, but I would say that for me, actually, coming from United States, I was even coming from Berkeley in the beginning, which is really a place of activism. And yet it was always inspiring to go to Israel because they were doing things that we weren't doing. Like, you know, Israeli women were meeting with Palestinian women trying to develop common understanding of what both life were. Very different setting, and they were trying to develop common statement that was pleasing and acceptable to both sides. And I don't feel that we really do this work in the United States with our sisters that are African American. We do not really do this work with our sisters that are Native American Indian and with all the immigrants that live and arrive in this land. So we very Eurocentric in some way. And so I was always impressed they were developing documentary together. I mean, the Israeli woman did a documentary and the Palestinian woman did one, and then they would come together to compare their documentary. They went to villages to speak to women, to try to engage them in meetings, to, you know, learn the language of each other and explain to each other the different cultural tradition and what one word meant in one tradition and what it means in another. Basically, Israelis are very well aware that they came from Europe. They were not based in the ancient culture, the Bedouin culture, that grew out of the Middle East, of which most of our three religious tradition come from this Bedouin tradition that had, is very close in many ways to the Native American tradition of the Great Spirit and living in respect for the earth and respect with each other, honor, respect, generosity, hospitality, which you find a lot in the third world, those traditions, and are so warm-hearted to us. But the, for the Israeli were Western people that came in, so they had to discover through the process of living over 50 years in this land what the indigenous tradition had to offer them and to open their mind enough to be able to listen and to understand.
But it sounds like you see the possibility for change. You see some good things happening along those lines.
Yeah, I've on both sides, I see nonviolent activists that, and so many families that hope to live in peace one day so their children can prosper. The Middle East is such a beautiful country and it has so much things to offer. And even to us, I mean, after all, a lot of our civilization come from there. So rather than be so judgmental about what it is to be Muslim, what it is to be Christian, what it is to be Jewish, I think it's more that, okay, let's try to understand each other and see what common ground do we have so we can build on those traditions rather than just be so quick to judge each other. But what we are really trying to look at is the foreign policies of our countries. And that's really the focus that we have now, and because we are really devastated by those foreign policies. And, you know, so many women have recently, I mean, U.S. women have lost their son and daughters, and so many Iraqi people are losing their children. And it's not something that we can just bypass. I mean, this is killing each other. And that's, you know, something that all the tradition, you know, say you shall not kill. And we have to look at a civilization that's really establishing itself on the murder of other people. We have to look what it does to us and to our culture and why this is happening and try to understand.
I'm speaking with Odile Huguenot-Haber. And she is the co-chair of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Middle East Campaign, and co-chair of the National Campaign of Wealth. And also, as I mentioned earlier, with us is Yvonne Simmons. Yvonne, it looked like maybe you were about to add something to what Odile was saying.
I think she's speaking so well. She's saying it much better than I could. But I think in the beginning you said 97. I think you meant 87.
Oh, yeah,
when you became a member of Women in Black, because I remember being with you in Riverside when there was an international women's conference on violence against women
and women in wars. You know, women are being raped everywhere in wars, and we have to look at the culture of why those rapes are happening and why, you know, children and women are the primary victims of wars. What's going on? Why are those wars going on? Why are we spending $150 million a day in the Iraq war? You know, we have to ask a lot of questions, and we really have to say, hey.
Well, one thing I'd like to say about the Iraqi war is that what is happening to the U.S. women soldiers and to the Iraqi women, they are being raped. The U.S. women soldiers are being raped. There's been a case where the bathrooms were very near the men's barracks, and so the women would not drink water after 3 p.m. And I don't know how many, died from dehydration, and they would not put that on the death certificate because if they went to the bathroom, more than likely they'd be raped.
By their fellow soldiers.
Yes, yeah.
American soldiers.
And American soldiers are also raping Iraqi women. They're setting up brothels. There was one case where three women were working in a brothel where the U.S. would go for sex. And when the males in their family found out, they were killed. They call it honor killing.
But that's not new. I mean, the U.S. is in about 100 other countries, I think, has military presence. And it's well known that around U.S. base, there is prostitution, there is a lot of poverty, and so.
But in Iraq, it wasn't, the U.S. bases weren't there, so there wasn't this problem. This problem has begun since the invasion of Iraq nearly 3 years ago. Also, it's the archaeological sites that are being destroyed. There was a base near Babylon, and one of the first civilizations was there, and it's being destroyed. It was destroyed by the base, and the soldiers didn't know what it meant. And I think that they say they try to sensitize, and if they did, maybe things would be different. They're not trained to really win over the people, to really get to know who the people are. I think many soldiers do because it's in their nature. Mm-hmm. These people are very young. They've never been in a situation like that. And unfortunately, what they're told from whoever is up there of what they have to do is mostly destruction. And destruction doesn't bring peace.
Yvonne, I wanted to ask you about the story that you told about the women not going to the restroom. Where did you hear about that?
From Marjorie Cohen, who is the president of the Lawyers Guild. She was in town last year, and she spoke at a Women in Black rally. And I've heard it again since. I've heard several emails.
Yeah, it's been on the internet.
Yeah.
What we do in our campaign, we focus on the Iraq war, but we also focus on Israel and Palestine, because it's our belief that Israel and Palestine is at the heart of this conflict. Because mm-hmm. in a sense, for many years now, the Muslim world has seen the Palestinian being kind of really killed and maimed and beaten up and their house destroyed by the Israeli occupation, and that is funded by the U.S. tax dollar and by U.S. weapons. And so they've seen the brutality. They see all those things that we don't see on our TVs. And they're very well aware that the Palestinian conflict has kind of opened that sore, and the fact that the Western world has such an unjust ways of dealing with the native people who live on the ground. And most of the U.S. policies has been developed through a series that comes from white middle class men, and they have this vision either that Western civilization brings progress to the world, and through globalization, through free trade, free market, intense consumerism, mm-hmm. and so that their vision of bringing happiness and democracy through the world, through those free trade. And the other one is the concept of the clash of civilization, that the Western might respect different cultures, but the Western culture needs to be more intensified if it wants to stand up to other cultures like Islamism, which is growing, and or the Chinese culture or other cultures. But it's not based on women, on feminist analysis of what the world is about, what nature is about, or culture of working people, or culture of native people.
Also, I think we have to look at Israel as a nuclear power, mm-hmm. and which the U.S. has supported that, because they want Israel as a nuclear power in the Middle East, because with Israel as a nuclear power, the U.S. has more control.
Mm. Well, actually, it was started by the French, but it was developed then later on by the U.S. I think it was because they wanted to protect this Western civilization from Arab nations around it. They always said this tiny little country surrounded by Arab nations, and the aim was to protect the pipelines at... And what's happening to Israel and Palestine is kind of the microcosm of what's happening to the global corporate world versus, like I said, the indigenous world. But eventually our Western corporate world is not sustainable, and we will have to go back and base ourselves to those indigenous practices, because eventually that's the only long-term mm-hmm. survival on this planet. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that we're destroying those cultures, and yet they offer us our long-term survival.
Were you surprised by the Hamas victory?
No.
No,
I wasn't at all.
Having there in Israel and Palestine, I have seen, in fact, Israel even supported Hamas. I mean, I was told that many times over, because they wanted to kind of split, and the Palestinian groups, they all, because that's how you conquer, by splitting, you know, doing factions. But they also wanted to rationalize the fact that, you know, if they on one hand gave more support to a faction that was less non-violent, then they could rationalize the destruction that they were doing in the occupied territory.
Because I think that Hamas has a very good social program.
Yeah.
It feeds the people, it educates the people, it helps the people.
It's
so much, and Fatah was supposed to be working on the peace process, and there was a lot of corruption in the Fatah government, and nothing happened. I mean, the Israelis were not working with Fatah, really, you know, because look, that they might be saying
even
or not be saying.
Even within Israel, there is a town near Megiddo called Umm el-Farem, and Umm el-Farem used to have a socialist mayor, and this mayor was married to a Swedish woman, and he was traveling abroad, he was connected to the communist movement, traveling a lot abroad to conferences. And while he was there, there was an Islamic man who started installing sewage in the town and getting all the young people into digging trenches so they could fix the sewage in this town. So the next thing that happened, and that's within Israel proper, then, you know, this Islamic faction was elected. And so, because they could see that this young man was doing something within the town, he kind of installed a clinic and they opened some school. And so they were doing things in the town. They are the parties of the poor people. And we have to remember that even Islam, there is this tradition of generosity, of courage, honor, and that appeals to people. We have to understand also what's happening within the relationship of the people. And they could see that the U.S. with the Western world helped with Israel only had to offer them this kind of intense militarization and military occupation of their street and all those armaments, and didn't offer them the school, the clinic, you know, the progress that they needed, because basically, like I said, most people want to live better. That's at the bottom of human heart, is you want a better life. The military occupation that has been funded by the U.S. affect both countries. I mean, it affects the people in Israel, where this increased militarization affected when the soldier went to serve in the occupied territory. They would come home and the wife battering was on the increase. The whole aspect of life within Israel become more militarized, and that means a lot of the social program were cut, so there is more poverty. So in a way, both women from both camps suffered at different levels, but the Israeli women were suffering also from the military occupation, just as the Palestinian women were suffering on a different level. But I could say that all women in the world are affected by the increase in militarization that's going on, and military budgets are really out of control. And then we don't have school for our children. So one in every four children in the United States is malnourished. So, you know, we really have to look at what's happening, what's the effect of those policies, how it's affecting our children and the children of the other women who live on this planet. When we start sharing our resources, when we start developing kind of not a domination of other people, but kind of a cooperative partnership, then I think our technology and our resources for all people will increase on this planet. And we would feel so much happier to know that, you know, most people can live with maybe more simpler life, but much happier life.
I would like to qualify poverty. After working the last year and a half in Lima, Peru, and seeing poverty in other parts of the world, the poverty in the U.S. is very different. I think sometimes, I used to call it when I first came here, a poverty of mind. Because in America, there's everything. If you don't have food, there is a way you can get food. There's a lot of food banks, there's a lot there, and if you want clothes, there's a lot. You can get these things, but people have so much. And poverty is because I don't have it. And sometimes that's how people see poverty, or poverty because I can't go to the cinema, or I can't. And it's very real for the person that can't do these things because they have the example of all, you know, around them of everybody who can do a lot more than they can. So I don't know what how I would term it, you know, describe it, but when you see poverty to the extent of people having no running water, no clean water to drink, and when they have hardly any food, and when they have to rummage around garbage with their bare hands, and kids at 3 years old are making bricks.
So that's,
you know, it's a very different, you know, I would call that poverty.
Yeah.
You know,
but that's, you know, the cost of now we're developing this transnational elite. And that's the cost of developing this small amount of elite versus, you know, the multitudes that exist on this earth. And I think it's coming to a climax because we have so many nuclear weapons. And eventually it might come to that, you know, that the poorest nation will grab nuclear weapon and fight in the war. So it's really the time, I think, to really look at who are we on this earth, you know, and turning our heart to another way of living on this planet. Because if we don't, then it will be the destruction of all. Now it's about nuclear weapon and this whole planet existing, and we're working for a development of a Middle East nuclear free zone, but we have to be really honest and look at what we are doing with our nuclear weapon and why the US is not signing any of those NPT treaties. Why aren't they respecting the Article 6 that says we have to decrease our nuclear weapon? You know, we cannot keep, it's like we are like a spoiled kid on the block that has all the marble in his pocket and say to all of the kids, you can't have any. I mean, that never lasts a long time, because eventually the poor kids gang up against the rich kid and they share the marble, you know. And so it's really the time to say, let's go for a turning of heart.
Well,
let's change our ways.
Some indigenous.
And it's affecting our daily life, and we live in misery, even if we have a lot of things.
Have you got any hope there?
So the hope is to make this appeal. We have to make this appeal to the people in power. We have to find out who are those families, who are they, you know, who are those 0.1% or... And we are part of them in some ways. We are the 1% who have, you know, a house, we have a bank account, we have something to eat, while millions live on less than $1 a day. So we have to really, to kind of change our ways of living and
have
a
grassroots.
It's not easy unless we really share together and we have this solidarity from one to another. And
it's very long-term, unfortunately.
And love it has to be there, you know, love has to be there, because the only effect of not having all those things is sharing more, is treating each other with more respect.
I want to thank you, Odile, for coming in and stopping by Cabo while you were in town, and hope that you have a good experience here and also a good trip back to Ann Arbor.
Thank you.
And let people know again that we've been hearing from Odile.
Hugo Nohaber.
Thank you, Odile.
Could I say one more thing? Mm-hmm. On March 19th, there's the third anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, and there's going to be a march and a rally at 1:30. People are starting to gather. The speaking will start at 2 at Waterfront Park, where it was just over 3 years ago.
Okay, sure. Let's see. We want to hear from Yvonne.
Yeah, and this is a song. I call it the women's
song. Non-violence for the children of the world.
I call it the women's song. How could anyone ever tell you that you're anything less than beautiful? How could anyone ever tell you that you're less than whole? How could anyone fail to notice that your loving is a miracle? How deeply you're connected to my soul. And it's for all us women here and out there.
Thank you, Yvonne Simmons. Thank you very much. Odile, thank you too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Kathleen for KBOO.